Great. Well, thank you, Sarah. And let me say first how pleased I am to be in conversation with you again. We have many years of conversation between us, all of which I'm most grateful for. And I want to thank Dasingho for inviting me here, and a gracious, generous invitation. And many of you I have never met before. I also just want to take a moment to say on this day, the people of Gaza continue to be hurt, to be damaged, to be destroyed. And their ways of life, their cities, their shelters, their hospitals, their educational institutions have either been fully destroyed or on the way to being destroyed. And I know many of us have spoken up and done what we can to object to this ongoing genocide, and yes, it is a genocide. But our countries have collaborated. They have not undertaken boycott, divestment, and sanctions. They have not stopped the embargoes. They have not put an embargo on the arms trade. They have not used all of the economic, ethical pressure that they have at their disposal. And my country in particular is actively supporting and sometimes even directing the activities on the ground. So it is with great anger and great shame and great sorrow that we meet here today, and whatever we speak about, we must also be speaking about Gaza. We can't turn away. And not because when we look at them, we see ourselves. We see someone else. We see another group of people, a group of people who are less protected than most of us. And we also must see that difference. Not to berate ourselves or to wallow in guilt, but to understand the operation of power, the violent operation of power that establishes an entire group of people as dispensable, as worthy of being killed, as ungrievable, as not belonging to the humanity to which we ostensibly belong. But we are, of course, those of us who are indirectly responsible, and certainly those who are directly responsible, have lost some part of their own humanity because of what we have permitted and what we permit still. So I say this so that we can acknowledge this vast failure of human ethical obligation during this time in human history. I am not sure how anyone will recover from the devastations that have been wrought there. And it brings up fundamental questions of belonging. You know, in the beginning, yes, of course, in the beginning was gender. It's like, oh, here's Judith. Judith's a girl, right? So, yes, in the beginning was gender, right? But, you know, I'm also Yehudit. I'm Judith. I'm the Jewish girl. I am the feminine form of the Jewish child. So my gender, my name, my religion all came in a single blow. an interpolation, a very strong interpolation. But I had no idea what any of that would mean, except when an infant is named or an infant is brought into the world, as I was in the mid-50s, as, you know, televisions were being installed in homes, as the aftermath of the Nazi genocide was felt throughout my family, who lost family there. My grandparents speaking Yiddish. You know, I mean, I was American, but I was also linked to a European history that was in my house and in my education and in my world. But what I want to say is that we never know what those expectations are that come with the name. So, little Judith, little Yehudit, Shana Perel is my Yiddish name. I don't know who follows that. Somebody does. See, I knew there was somebody who did. Why? What were they expecting from me? Terrible. But you don't know those expectations, but they come at you. They come at you, and they include things like normative gender and being a girl, or being a Zionist, or being part of the Jewish community that has a consensus on Zionism. Although in the mid-50s, in the United States, there was no absolute consensus on Zionism. It didn't really emerge until after the 67 war. You could have open debates in the mid-1950s in Jewish communities on Zionism. And if you were against Zionism, you were, you know, that was a position you had. It didn't make you an anti-Semite. It made you, if you were Jewish, you were just another Jewish anti-Zionist. You could be a Bundist, you could be a Universalist, you could say diaspora is the place to be, we like diaspora. You know, there were many ways of being Jewish, and people didn't look at each other and say, oh, you have bad opinion, you must be a self-hating Jew, or you must be an anti-Semite. But I'm just putting these two together in a way, Sarah, because I don't know. Was I gendered before I was Jewish? Was I Jewish before I was gendered? Was I gendered Jewish, Jewish, gendered? I don't know. But I was also Ashkenazi, so I was white. And I was white in a time in which the neighborhoods in which I was living were starting to be integrated. So there was a consciousness of being white. And there was not yet a civil rights movement, but that did start when I was, in my mind, it came to my mind when I was 7, and I was aware that there was a struggle, and that people were not treated equally, and that they were excluded from neighborhoods, and that they did not belong. And I had a sense that I did belong because I was in a Jewish community that made sure we belonged, but I was also aware that if you went to a different part of town, you didn't belong. So, I don't know, belonging and non-belonging seems to me very often to be a struggle. For the most part, I felt that belonging was a way of being absorbed into other people's beliefs. Like, oh, I'm going to belong to this or that community, that means I must conform. So I was always...
You're never good enough.
I was very ambivalent.
Yeah.
You know, even now, like, there are these excellent groups on campus that are fighting for the freedom of Palestinians, and of course I support them totally, but the minute they ask me to sign an oath, I'm like, I'm not signing oath.
You're not signing.
I don't sign oaths. So I'm willing to risk not belonging if it feels like coercion.
But I can imagine, as you tell the story now, that indeed it just all, the interpolations are entangled and come as a blow, as you said, come on you. But then in your intellectual work, you know, you wrote this book, Gender Trouble. Mm-hmm. And then, what is it, maybe 2 decades later, you wrote Parting Ways in relation to Zionism. So then intellectually, you started to disentangle some of these questions to really unpack what is the problem with gender norms and gender normativity, or unpack, and I think I still remember having a conversation with you before Parting Ways, when you were finishing the book, before it came out, when it felt very uneasy. I think I remember you saying, like, I'm nervous about this book, I'm nervous about putting it out there. So in your intellectual work, while in your lived life, of course, it is all entangled, but then in your intellectual work, you did begin tackling some of these things that came as a blow to you. No?
Well, you know, it's always hard this moment to explain, but there's certain things that became known publicly at certain times. Okay, so before Gender Trouble, I was just working in continental philosophy, and then I wrote something on gender. People said, oh, you became interested in gender. It's like, no, I was interested in gender my whole life. I just happened to write something.
Yeah.
So if you ask me about Zionism, like, oh, you turned to Zionism. Did I turn to Zionism in 2013-14 to write a book? No, I was struggling with Zionism my whole life.
Yeah.
And in my 20s, fighting against my formation,
yeah.
Realizing through a fair amount of study what I had been taught about the Zionist colonization of Palestine, never used the word colonization, and never acknowledged the radical dispossession, the land theft, the violence, or indeed the massacres that led to 1948. And even in 48, I wasn't taught at all about the different options there were for state formation that were actively debated and indeed continue to be debated through the 60s. I was told something false, and I was given a very romantic idea of Jewish sanctuary in the land of Palestine. But when you write a book on it and you go public, you lose your family.
Your family.
You lose your community. You can't go home again. So there are two or three members of my family who still speak to me, but I've never been able to go home again.
Even now?
And you risk that.
Yeah.
You risk it. It's a very hard loss.
Yeah.
But that is a refusal to participate. That comes with a loss. But at the same time, there are all these other people who are refusing to participate. And then you've got a new community. And plus, it's not just your Jewish pals, it's your Jewish and your Palestinian pals, and it's a bunch of other people, too, from various backgrounds, who are coming into like a strong multicultural, multilingual discussion about anti-Zionism, or about Palestinian freedoms, or about new state formations, or about resistance movements, and how best to conduct them, and what aspirations there might be. So, you know, I got adopted into other communities where belonging was better. But belonging...
Yeah? Belonging?
I never want belonging to be complete.
Yeah.
I feel like if any of us completely belonged to somewhere, we would be absorbed and captured. I know that when you belong nowhere, the desire to belong is absolutely crucial, right? So when Hannah Arendt says, we all have a right to have rights, and then she continues that, to explicate a right to belong to a polity, right, to a society. So the right of belonging is one that she insisted on, and it became the basis for her own thinking about the rights of refugees. She herself had been one. So the right to belong is an enormously important right, and it's not even an individual right, it's a shared right, it's a shared condition of life. When you say, we each have the right to belong, you're saying, we belong to a shared condition of life, and we should equally belong to that shared condition. And the problem with Eichmann, in her view, is that he didn't realize that we all belonged, and he thought he could decide who belonged to the living and who did not, who could share in this life and who could not share in this life. But even longing to belong from the place of radical exclusion usually comes with some criticism of what it might mean to belong. Because if belonging is assimilation to the point where I must efface my history, or if it's conformity to a set of norms that are excluding others, well then, no, I want to belong, but I want to keep a critical relationship to the norms that we share, including the norms we don't yet share and that we should share, right? More radical ideas of shared existence than those that exist for us now. So I think the critical spirit has to interrupt and coincide with the desire to belong, that there should always be a disturbance in the sphere of belonging.
And indeed, I like how you put it, that it should never be complete because of, well, the potential violence and exclusion that is enacted when a belonging is complete, right?
Well, the absolute conformity,
and the conformity.
Right, complete belonging is that it can be, it's not always, but it can be a radical conformity that overcomes difference. And I think we must keep difference alive, including those differences that make us question, oh, what does it mean to belong?
Yeah.
Who belongs? What are the terms of belonging? Maybe we need to change the terms of belonging.
Yeah.
Right, to keep it active and keep it living and keep it expansive.
I do want to come back to gender.
Okay.
You can't escape it, Judith. So in, I think it was 2020, right? You formally changed your gender to non-binary in the state of California, right? And so non-binary, for you, is that a matter of belonging or non-belonging?
Yes.
Yes.
I asked
the wrong person. And I asked the binary question, which I shouldn't have done. But do you want to explain that, or is the answer no?
No, it's interesting because, you know, a lot of people think that gender is a matter of choice, and the question is, you know, what gender do you want to be? Like, oh, what gender do you want to be? Well, I want to be this gender, I want to be this gender. My question has always been, what does gender want of me? Right? Because it's making demands all the time, and I'm like, oh God, I can't do that. It talks at you, trips you up, you're like trying to go to the store and there's gender, somebody says something to you. Boy, I felt bad for the guy who said monsieur to me the other day, and then he was like, you know, he just didn't know whether that was right. And I couldn't reassure him because I didn't know what was right. And I saw he was suffering, but I just had no way. I just had no way to help him. I know, I'm sorry. I would have a late night television comedy show, but they would cancel me.
In the US, they would cancel you. But having said that, in which country? Okay, now we have to think countries where this would not be canceled. But so. Okay.
I'm sorry.
No, stop being sorry.
No, I'm non-binary. Look, non-binary. I feel like at the time that I wrote Gender Trouble, calling into question the binary was a critical activity. It never occurred to me that you could identify as non-binary. It seemed to me that non-binary thinking was about disidentifying with available categories. But of course, I also said at that time that categories change,
yeah,
and that there might be new ones. And people would always ask me, oh, like what kind? I said, I don't know, that's for you to figure out. But non-binary became oddly a category. And then I thought, okay, in some ways with many other people I helped to make it.
You did, yes.
But with many other people, and a lot of people mean things by it that I don't mean, and it's now definitely in the hands of others. But I thought, well, why not? If there is such a category, why not? And I could not think of a good reason not to. But do I identify in the sense of a strong feeling like, yes, this is who I am? Better that than some others. I mean, but it is true that my relationship to categories is kind of permanently queer, so maybe I'm a little more queer than I am non-binary, or I have a queer relation to non-binary. I think that's probably right.
So given all this, do we actually still need gender? And I am asking this question because in your latest book, Who's Afraid of Gender, you kind of raised the question as well, right? Do we still need gender? Or at least you show how gender has become this phantasm, this deep bundle of deep desires and anxieties about the world at large that is put together, projected on gender. Can we still do something there? Or is it time to move on and let the phantasm devour itself?
Well, unfortunately, the right-wing construction of gender, and I use that word purposefully, the right-wing anti-gender ideology movement is construing gender all the time as something that is destructive. It's either a form of indoctrination, it's a form of totalitarianism. You have done excellent work in this area, and in fact, I rely on your scholarship here to a large degree. But that construction effaces the ways in which gender has been important as part of anti-discrimination law, as part of social movements against rape and domestic violence and domestic rape. It effaces the way in which gender has permitted for change in civil status. Like if I can become non-binary, that means that this is a legal and historical category that can shift, or that I can shift or move between it. That's an exercise of freedom for me to make use of the law in that way. Gender is also a framework, you know, in scholarship that allows us to ask, well, why is the world organized in this way? And is it necessary that it is? So it's not just an identity, it's also the framework in which we ask fundamental questions about power differentials and how they work through categorization and how they work through practices and institutions and state policies. We can't even think socially, ethically, politically about healthcare without understanding gender and different kinds of healthcare that people need depending on their relation to gender or how they are constituted biologically and socially and culturally and legally. So I think there's no doing away with gender. Doing away with gender is what the right wing wants us to do. And they are trying to do away with gender by offering this deformation of scholarship and political policy as the truth of gender. So we must oppose the untruth. They're also practicing a version of social construction that I oppose. All right? I mean, they are constructing gender. They are showing that gender can be constructed. They are the ultimate constructivists.
The ultimate?
I think so. Yes, because if you believe the caricature of social construction, like, oh, you think gender can be whatever you want it to be, or you can just say what gender is and that's what gender is. Like, no, no, these are, you know, the history of gynecology, the history of rape, the institutionalized sexism, the deep transphobia that we find in several institutions. I mean, no, we're talking about forms of power that are sedimented and difficult to change and that must change. So, you know, in that sense, we can't just decide what gender is going to mean, because indeed it acts on us way before we start acting on it, right? It lays in wait for us. It's the blow, as it were, that greets you when you're born. With all of the institutional apparatus and the phantasmatic investments of not just parents, but institutions and religious institutions. So, you know, we can't do away with gender as if it's like an arbitrary framework. It's not. It's a form of power that is interconnected with race and class and capitalism and geopolitical movements and colonization. It would be at our peril that we would do away with gender.
Yeah, it's just I want to do away with the phantasm, but yes.
Well, but the one problem is that it always has that dimension.
Yeah, it just seems to be out of control.
It is out of control, yes.
So how not to feed the phantasm, but yes, indeed, yeah, everything that you said.
But we can't step away from the field, because then they do win.
Yeah. They will not win. We can't.
Okay.
Okay. But it does bring me to another domain, or that I would still like to question you about the question of belonging, non-belonging, and refusals, institutions. And I'm saying this both because I know many of us have to deal with institutions, whether it's like we deal with academic institutions, cultural institutions, educational institutions. And I'm also saying this because many here in this room have heard the news that your institution, UC Berkeley, has given the names of 160 students and faculty, handed it over like that to the Trump administration for alleged complaints of anti-Semitism, and your name being the most prominent one on that list. And there's no words for the betrayal, right? Like, there are no internal complaint procedures were followed. There's no words for this betrayal of just UC Berkeley giving the names to the Trump administration. So what do we do with these institutions? And I am reminded of earlier this year, it's still not a year, has gone. I mean, it's been relentless months, right? But earlier this year, when the Trump administration came into office, many of us, I think many in the US, but also many here, were reading Timothy Snyder's On Tyranny, right? The lessons of, Snyder's lessons of what to do with authoritarianism and the rise of authoritarianism. And the first lesson being, do not obey in advance, where I think you see a little bit of like the liberal quality of Snyder's thought, right? Because you could also make it do not obey, right? But okay, do not obey in advance. And then the second lesson is defend our institutions. Media, universities, all kind of institutions. But how do we defend these institutions where we, first of all, might have never belonged and that continue to betray us? And in this case, that you have been so betrayed by this institution. So how do we say we don't defend these institutions anymore, which, again, that would be, I guess, very difficult to say, but at the same time, how do we defend these institutions?
Well, it's interesting because I had a phone conversation with the head of legal counsel at the University of California at Berkeley, and he was explaining that the university was being investigated by the federal government for anti-Semitism. And there's an anti-discrimination policy called Title VI, which every university has to conform to, and it has to show that it has in place procedures that would handle complaints against faculty, students, staff, for racism, for anti-Semitism, for the discrimination against people with disabilities, discrimination on the basis of religion, and nationality, all of these. So Title VI actually requires that each institution has procedures through which complaints go, so that everybody gets heard, those who have been accused understand the accusation, can give their side of the story, and it can be adjudicated in a fair way. But the Trump administration decided that the way it wants to test for conformity to Title VI, right, is the institution doing what it needs to do to handle complaints of this sort, especially complaints or accusations of anti-Semitism. They wanted all of the allegations that have ever been made, even especially those that never were processed. So they were not testing to see whether the internal procedure of the university was working. They were telling the university to suspend their internal procedure and just give the names of anyone who has been accused or whose name is associated with an accusation. So I don't know whether I was accused. Yeah. All I know is that my name is in a file having to do with, pertaining to, an accusation of anti-Semitism. So it's like, I don't know if I'm accused. I don't know if I'm associated with an unsubstantiated accusation. Someone could have just said there's a rumor, or I heard a story, hearsay, rumor, slur, slander. It's like, okay, we'll take all of that.
And you don't know.
And I don't know.
So this is like Kafka.
But then when I say to the legal counsel, can I know what's in the file? He said, no, you cannot know what's in the file. And I said, did you think about not complying?
Yes. Do not
and
obey.
And he said, no. I said, may I ask why you did not think about that? Why did you not consider not complying? And he said, it is my job to defend the institution. And then my answer to him, he said, well, of course, sometimes we do the wrong thing and I make sure damages are paid. It's like, oh yeah. But then I said to him, is it your job to defend the highest ideals of the institution? Quiet. So when Snyder says defend our institutions, he might mean defend the highest ideals of the institutions or defend educational institutions against the kind of extortion and destruction to which they're subject. But you know, Snyder would get rid of literary criticism and literary theory and post-structuralism and Derrida and Butler. So he has some good things to say, and then he has some other things to say.
I know. And it all shows in advance. Just do not obey.
But it's also, like, why is it tyranny? Tyranny comes to us from the Roman tradition, really. Like, why isn't it authoritarianism or fascism? Anyway, he's useful.
To some extent. To some extent. But many of us were reading it, right?
Yes, of course.
Plus, he made his book into a graphic novel, and that helps. make your book into graphic novels.
I know, he sold many more copies than I did. But look, let me just say one other thing here, which is that, you know, institutions, educational institutions in Europe, in the US, in Australia, throughout the world, have been subject to a massive neoliberal takeover. And most of the people who now run institutions are not academics, but corporate, corporate managers, okay? And that kind of rationality is now running institutions. So when institutions of higher education become completely neoliberalized, they lose the capacity to say what value they have in the world, right? Because the values are all neoliberal values of, you know, efficiency and economy and functionalism and the like. We don't even talk about free and open inquiry. We don't talk about knowledge or what it means to learn how to read, think, to assess your world, to come up with judgments, to use evidence, and how important that is for democratic deliberation and for the future of democracy. We don't link universities to democracy anymore. We link them to certain forms of corporate rationality and profit. And grant making and grant receiving, especially from the government. And once that happens and the government can say, oh, we're gonna take all your funding away, or a lot of your funding, so that you're not gonna be able to function unless you hand over these names.
Because these governments are linking into democracy.
They are, but the...
They are making the link.
But the educational leaders are only concerned about keeping those grants because that's the only rationality they are working with, and they become moral cowards, and they sell out their communities. And at Berkeley, it's not just students, some of whom are international and can have their visas taken away in a moment, and faculty, some of whom are not tenured and are not protected by academic freedom, but administrative staff, people who've worked there for 20 or 25 years who depend on the longevity of their work in order to get a pension. So these are people's livelihoods that are being just bargained away. Okay, we don't have to spend all my time on that, but it is happening everywhere.
But it's happening everywhere.
And the capitulation is appalling.
It is happening everywhere. That's why we have to find a way to, the do not obey within the institutions, but I think you're very right to bring it back to the ideals and the values of what...
Yes, but, you know, the thing is that when I was talking to the legal counsel, I realized he'd never read Hannah Arendt, right?
That is the problem.
But I thought in philosophy 101, in political philosophy 101, you know, it's like, oh, there are a set of laws. Do you obey the laws? Do you not obey the laws? What if the laws are unjust laws? Oh, do I obey an unjust law or do I refuse to obey an unjust law? It's like basic thinking, which is also basic thinking about civil disobedience and the question of whether the law that's being imposed on you is just or unjust, which means the question of justice can't be answered simply through recourse to law, right? We need to have a framework of justice to distinguish between good and bad law, just and unjust law. But civil disobedience is not just a one act, a heroic act of someone who says no. It's a way of building community. It's a way of building collectivities. And it actually is a way of believing in and pursuing a just world that the law cannot necessarily give us and give us a perspective on law so that we are not just compliant. It involves collectivity, imagination, and critical judgment. And that's, you know, part of what we can learn through this resistance movement, which is, has now taken all kinds of forms, including a massive sanctuary movement in the United States, which is helping the undocumented and those who have been targeted.
And this, to me, links to well, the issue of ethics and world making, right? I mean, not
yes.
also community, but also really ethic world making. And I want to link that back to our question of belonging, non-belonging, and the refusals to belong. So how do we do ethics? What is an ethics based on that not absolute belonging? So kind of the ambiguity of belonging, non-belonging, the refusals. Because it seems to me that we have, that there is a sense that we sometimes need strong grounds of belonging in order to build, to do world making and to have an ethics of that world making. Whereas if we start from a more precarity of belonging or a more ambiguity of belonging and take the violence that claims of belonging inflict on others into account from the outset, how does ethics and world making look like? Can you expand on that? Like, we've already heard the figure of the conscious pariah from Hannah Arendt. You've already referred to Hannah Arendt. So we can think about this with Hannah Arendt. I think we can also think with Edward Said about this and the idea of out of place and the world making that we can do in relation to a notion of out of place. And how do we think with Judith Butler about this? Mm. I mean, of course, you take Arendt and Said with you, but I would really like to hear you more on that ethics, because it feels like it's an ethics that part of it might already be there, but we also really need to imagine it for that new world to be possible.
Mm. I mean, maybe we need to distinguish between, say, forms of nationalism that also rely on an idea of belonging, forms of racism, which you actually alluded to earlier, the forms of racism we find among Trump supporters or Orban supporters or even Meloni supporters, right? Or
Trump's Meloni supporters.
Yes, exactly. Just around the corner. There is a kind of furious nostalgia among racists. They want to get back to the time in which everybody was white and it was fine and there was superiority and there was dominance and there were lots of privileges that were according to whiteness, which have now been contested, and rightly so in our view, but in their view, they've been diminished. And they understand equality as a form of castration. What they've lost actually is supremacy. But very often the language that is used is belonging.
And not feeling at home.
Not feeling at home in their on their soil, you know, in their land. Because of course many people are now in their land and on that soil, and it is shared among us. But the idea of a shared condition of life, shared among those with different backgrounds, different histories, different languages, different orientations, but nevertheless shared, I mean, that could be a beautiful vision. I think it is a beautiful vision. I think we need to make it more beautiful. But it's hateful to some for whom homogeneity and whiteness in particular and its supremacy were the only way they had of understanding belonging. So one is not dispossessed by the difference of another, right? One is not dispossessed. One is confronted with a new condition of sharing. One is confronted with human complexity, with various histories, with various religious backgrounds. And there is conflict, and there is unknowingness, and there are epistemic limits that people come up against. That's true. But what does it mean to be committed to the struggle of understanding the radical heterogeneity and complexity of human life and human histories in a world in which our lives are converging all the time? There is an ethics to that. There's not one standard of belonging, but belonging becomes something like a commitment to the struggle to share the earth, and a commitment to the struggle to preserve the earth that we share. So the ecological struggle is absolutely connected to the struggle for equality. Absolutely connected. They can't be disconnected. I just think ethics, struggle, translation, right? Like literally and maybe also figuratively, being open to the language of the other, not assuming that that epistemic framework through which I see the world is the way everyone should see the world, undoing that arrogance, that imperialism of the everyday in our interactions, that is an ethic. It's a form of world making. But it does involve struggle, difference, sometimes anger, sometimes disbelief, sometimes hostility, right? But all of these things, including hostility, are ethical problems. What do we do with our hostility? How do we live our hostility? What can we make out of hostility? Muhammad Al-Kord talked about his contempt. But if we asked him, and I don't know how to do that, do you want to make a full life out of contempt? Or is dignity something you're striving for all humans? My guess would be that he has contempt for all those who refuse the dignity of other humans, and that he is struggling to distribute dignity radically, right? Like a world in which dignity is radically distributed, and not by some sovereign power, but by each other all the time, right? As a reciprocal action of life. I mean, it's not easy. It's not easy, you know? I think I was talking to a group in Spain who were interested in the problem of peace, and they said, you know, peace has been just thrown out. Like, nobody talks about peace anymore. And I thought, well, the Oslo Accords made peace really hard to talk about, since that was a really painful, broken promise, and is surely part of the history of what we're seeing on the ground there today in Palestine. But what if we didn't separate peace from conflict, aggression, exasperation, murderous impulse? In other words, what if all of that negativity was part of peace, right? Like you want to destroy, or you understand the desire to destroy, and you don't. You do something else with it. You cultivate your rage into art. You cultivate your, no, go ahead.
No, I said no, rage rooms.
Rage rooms, or maybe you build some rooms with your rage. No, maybe you build something with your rage. I mean, there's a lot to be done with rage, including dancing. No, seriously, I mean, it's not about obliterating all those emotions that are destructive. It's about learning how to work with those feelings, as unbearable as they are, to make a world together. And that's not easy. But it's not just about being loving all the time. I mean, it could be very tough love, right? It could be very rough love. And I think we don't understand those practices of constructive conflict as well as we might. We tend to suppress them out of fear, and we would rather just dwell in the domain of peaceable love. And I understand that. I would like some peaceable love myself.
But I mean, thank you for, you are doing that work to make this ethic of, you know, commitment to shared conditions of life, to sharing the earth, to shared humanity, to make it more beautiful. I think we do need more of that, that ethics and world building. I do have another question. I'm also thinking of time, but I do think, how do we really make it work? So I want to move now towards how can we make some of these things work more concretely, right? And ethics and world making without a solid framework of law, international law, human rights, right to asylum, genocide convention, the entire framework that was born out of the genocide,
yes,
of the Second World War, which is crumbling now. And, you know, and I don't know if this is a fair way of putting it, but it keeps on coming back to my mind when after the Holocaust, Adorno spoke about, I mean, I know there's some misquotation here as well, but, you know, the possibility of poetry after the Holocaust.
Yeah.
And the possibility of international law after Gaza, right? Where, what, how can we even imagine? So this ethics sounds like entirely what we need to do now, and I think we need those frameworks, or do we need other frameworks?
Well, we do need Francesca Albanese.
We need a Francesca Albanese. Yes.
I mean, and she's on that flotilla. I hope she's on it and she's okay.
Yeah.
I worry. But look, if you go back, I have two answers for you, one of which is the following. If we go back to the Genocide Convention and look at what Raphael Lemkin had to say about what it is to try to destroy the life of a people, he was very clear that genocides destroy lives, take bodies, murder, deliberately through targeted action, absolutely. They also destroy forms of life, by which he means all the institutions that allow for life to be reproduced. So we might think along the lines of social reproduction, right? On healthcare, shelter, education. So the destruction of hospitals, the destruction of food sources, the tactical starvation, the destruction of almost every educational institution are all ways of trying to make sure that the life of the Palestinian people cannot be reproduced, that their future will be foreclosed. It's an attack on the future, which is what Karma Nabulsi says when she's defining scholasticide. To destroy educational institutions that belong to a people is to destroy the possibility of the future, and in her language, also the very ability to imagine a future. So to assassinate the imagination. But there's poetry coming out of Gaza still. And I'm not sure they've ever read Adorno, and if they did, they're probably not going to pay attention to that. But seriously, I just want to say here that the alliances that have formed to support Palestine, to insist upon the end of the genocidal attacks, to dignify the Palestinian people. These alliances are enormously important. They are also full of conflict. People arguing about armed resistance, no armed resistance. People arguing about what place Jews have, what place non-Jews have. I mean, we know this. Not all of these groups get along, and yet they're struggling in some way without resolution. And sometimes, and I think this is maybe the most important point I would say about belonging. It's going to sound maybe a little bit silly, but I remember as a young person going to feminist meetings or women's studies gatherings, and everyone would have to say something about their identity, whether or not they were feminist, and then again, you'd have to say whether you were lesbian or